Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 28th of August 2016. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Phil from the West End Whingers and Gareth James. We're now going to talk about Our Ladies of Perpetual Succour, which is a play by Lee Hall, adapted from the novel The Sopranos by Alan Warner. It's playing at the Dorfman Theatre at the National Theatre and is directed by Vicky Featherston, Artistic Director of the Royal Court, with music supervised by Martin Lowe. It concerns a choir from Oban in the Scottish Highlands who go down to Edinburgh for a competition but would much rather spend their time drinking and going to parties, although they're all teenagers. I think they're all around 16 or 17, so they certainly shouldn't be drinking. Phil, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Well, I went really on the strength of the reviews. So I thought about going to see it, and I thought I wasn't sure. And it just sounded my kind of thing. So, I mean, ultimately, I came out slightly disappointed for a particular reason. First, the kind of, it's very in your face, it's very sweary, it's very, very rude. So, you know, you wouldn't take somebody who's easily shocked, and I'm not easily shocked. But that did ultimately become I found it became a little bit exhausting watching them. The cast, though, are fantastic. I didn't know any of them previously. I thought they were all played their parts very well. They have got sort of quite a cross-section of young girls that are there. There's one who's had cancer and has been to Lourdes and apparently been given a miracle cure, who wants to make up for lost time. There's one with quite a few fathers. There's one that's a bit posh and bright, that's apparently brighter than the rest. There's one that's in a band. You know, it's sort of thing. And they do separate the characters quite well, and they also play the male roles in it, which I think they do rather well, although there was occasionally a couple of moments where I did become a bit confused, probably because the man next to me was loving it so much that he was literally rolling in it around in his seat, laughing at literally everything very, very loudly, which put me in a bit of a grumpy mood. I thought that the music, which is very eclectic, there's Mendelssohn, Bartok, and at the end, I thought a brilliant a cappella version of No Woman, No Cry. But interspersed with these are about half a dozen Electric Light Orchestra numbers. I'm a big fan of ELO, which was a treat to hear them do that. They start off with Mr. Blue Sky, which is just lifts me up. So I loved that contrast between that. And they sort of switch between the singing and the telling the story very, very well. But I just found myself not laughing as much as I expected to, or as much as the rest of the audience, and particularly the man next to me, were laughing. So a sort of slight disappointment, really, I think, due to my expectations, perhaps. Perhaps if I'd seen it without having seen the reviews, I would have come away sort of knocked out by it, as most people seem to have been done. But how did you come out of it?
I enjoyed it for what it was. I had a slight problem with some of the music. I mean, it is a little bit odd to have ELO, because I enjoy the Electric Light Orchestra's music quite a lot, but the problem I had with it was, firstly, I didn't believe that, well, there is a little bit of difficulty with the setting, because it kind of feels as if it's set now, but there are lots of references to places like Woolworths and the lack of mobile phones and stuff like that, which would place it much closer to when the novel came out, which would be sort of the late 90s. And I think that the problem with that is that you don't think girls of the late 90s or even girls of 2016 would be that enamoured of ELO. I mean, it's something of an acquired taste. It's not exactly One Direction, is it? It is a little bit odd. I mean, they were never, I don't think ELO were ever cool. And the other problem with it is that ELO's music, the clue is in the name of the band, Orchestra, and it's very, well, not overproduced, but it's very heavily produced, and also the arrangements are very complex, and the singers didn't really get that. I mean, I did have a lot of problems with, I didn't think that the harmonizations in this were particularly exciting. I mean, when you've got this idea of a choir, you want the variety in the voices, and obviously there can't be total variety in the voices when you've got sort of girls all about the same age. They are going to sound quite alike, but they didn't feel to me enough variety in the voices. I mean, there are one or two who can, you know, sing quite high and one or two who can sing quite low, but it wasn't really taking advantage of that range, I thought, and really bringing the music out. And as I said, you've got the complex stuff of ELO, but they're not singing it in a complex way, nor are they singing it in of a stripped down and very simple way. It's a sort of a messy middle, and I didn't really get on with that. Although there's nothing wrong with the singers, it's more the arrangements that I'm having an issue with. I would have wanted the arrangements here to be a lot more adventurous, especially when you're talking about a choir who would be, hopefully if they're up for a competition, they might be expected to have been properly trained in ways to really harmonize the voices. So I didn't think that was particularly strong. The rest of it, I mean, it does feel like something I've seen before quite a lot. You know, you've seen quite a lot of the kind of the antics of bad schoolgirls. It does have a long antecedence, and this was not, it didn't particularly surprise me. But there are some very nice touches in there, and there are some really nice performances. Unfortunately, it's a while back, and I can't absolutely pick out any of the particular actresses, but they were very impressive in many ways.
I wonder if Electric Light Orchestra is a particular favourite of Lee Hall, and perhaps that was his thing. And that's fine by me. I do think, yeah, it would be odd for girls of that age in that period to be that obsessed, because there's sort of been a kind of a Jeff Lynne renaissance recently where people, as they do, suddenly discover stuff. And yeah, it's very overproduced, and that's why I like it. Although, funnily enough, the numbers I enjoyed most in this were, and I'm not a classical music fan, but the classical numbers that they did when they were actually meant to be singing in their choir, which they're so desperate to get out of. And also the No Woman, No Cry at the end, which was done a cappella, which just sent shivers up my spine. So it's odd, given that I love the LLO, that those became my sort of favourite bits of the singing. But I did find it wore me down a little bit. It's an hour and 50 minutes with no interval, which is fine by me. And I felt it could have actually been trimmed slightly.
There is that idea that it goes on for a little bit longer than you might want. But in the end, I thought it was an entertaining evening and an interesting look into these lives. I think it's a decent adaptation, possibly a decent adaptation of the book. I've read More Than Colour, another book by Alan Warner, but not this one. So it certainly makes me want to go back and look at his books a little bit more.
What I found quite amazing is that it's been sort of knocking around for over a year now with the same cast. It's travelled sort of throughout Scotland and various places in the UK. I got a feeling, I saw a review, I think, by Ben Brantley. Did it go to the States for a couple of weeks or something? It doesn't get mentioned in the playlist that I picked up, but I've got a feeling they did it in New York somewhere, outside New York. Anyway, it's quite remarkable, I think, that it seemed very fresh to me, as though they were doing it for the first time, in a good way, rather than in a tired way. The energy up there is extraordinary.
We're now going to talk about They Drink It in the Congo by Adam Brace, directed by Michael Longhurst at the Almeida Theatre. This production concerns a committee trying to organise a festival of Congolese culture. This is the Democratic Republic of Congo we're talking about. I still kind of think of it as Zaire, which it was for about 30 years. It being slightly easier than confusing it with the Republic of Congo, I think the major difference is that the Democratic Republic of Congo was colonized rather cruelly by the Belgians, and Congo, the Republic of Congo, was colonized slightly less cruelly by the French. All colonists are wrong. We should say that to start off with. But what is happening here is somebody's trying to create a festival of Congolese culture and running up against Congolese history and the Congolese diaspora, where we have a mixture of people who are still harping after the days of Mobutu's dictatorship, when it was called Zaire, and possibly slightly in favour or slightly against the current so-called democratic state of Congo, and both in terms of its name and in terms of whether or not democracy has taken full hold there. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, the issues both in the past and in the present that face the so-called Democratic Republic of Congo are actually very complex. And this play seeks to examine them, really, through what I thought was a very comprehensive examination of the issues through the diaspora of the DRC, as it's called, in London, and indeed through the NGOs as well. And actually, I mean, it sounds very dry, but actually was, I thought, surprisingly funny and rather entertaining in a kind of black humour sense. And I thought that emphasised the tragedy and indeed the hopelessness of the situation in the DRC. The play revolves around this character, Steph, who was born in Kenya, so she's a white Kenyan. She's the daughter of a white farmer who's no longer with us, and she now lives in the UK, and she's working in some sort of government role, although it wasn't so clear to me what that was. And she, as you say, she's trying to organise a festival which is called Congo Voice, and the purpose of the festival is to raise awareness about the issues facing the country. And she has a steering committee on which she insists that a third of it is the Congolese diaspora in London is made up from that, and the rest of it is made up from NGOs, herself, and indeed a PR man who's her ex, which becomes important later on. And they go about persuading poets and musicians and writers and indeed photographers. But their planning is jeopardized because London members of a particularly militant aspect of the Congolese diaspora seek to prevent them from going about it. And at the end of the first half, we begin to understand why Steph is doing this, why she's so passionate about this, because we flash back to a visit she makes to the DRC where she witnesses the aftermath of an atrocity, and that's her real motivation. So when we come back in the second half, the plans unravel for the event because everyone virtually pulls out for one reason or another. And the whole situation is kind of mired in politics and vested interests. And the real interest of the Congolese people is lost in all of this. The priorities and their interests are just nowhere to be seen, really. A lot of the Congolese diaspora, who don't come over terribly well in the play, have not actually been there. And Steph sort of is working very hard to achieve something that looks pretty unachievable, really. And it covers an awful lot of ground because it covers the Portuguese slave trade, which started in the 16th century, I think, and then through this dreadful Belgian colonization and then dictators past and present. And the play doesn't really spare anyone. It doesn't spare the colonists or the Western governments or the African neighbors or the global businesses or indeed both the military militia, the tribal militia and the NGOs and the diaspora that we meet as part of this process, really. And the reason the Congo is, the core reason has got a lot to do with it's very rich in minerals. And these minerals are very important to a lot of the gadgets that we use today. And that kind of, that trade is really fueling the whole sort of cycle of violence, particularly against women, that the country is experiencing. I actually thought it was a very good play because I thought it covered the issues very comprehensively. Obviously, there were sort of devices to do that. It used this white woman who was passionate because of a visit, and it used the diaspora and the NGO. So there was an extent to which I probably, you know, would accept that it's just a little bit contrived. But in terms of what you learn about the issues for the Congo and in terms of entertainment, for want of a better word, for the player, I actually thought it succeeded very much. And the playwright, Adam Brace, isn't very prolific. I mean, I've only seen, I think he's only done one stage play before, which is called Stovepipe, which was about private security firms in post-conflict Iraq. But that was about 7 years ago, and that was a site-specific piece, which Michael Longhurst, I think, also directed. And I thought it was, you know, I just kind of kept thinking, well, why don't we get more from him? Because I would quite like to see more of his work, really. So I thought it was a good play. It was very, very good production, and indeed it's got a very, very good cast. There's lots of multiple roles, and indeed it puts a band on stage as well. So I enjoyed it. I thought it was worth catching. Maybe a little rough at the edges, but in the grand scheme of things, as a new play, a worthy one for me. But maybe not for you, Tim.
Yes. My problems with this, I mean, one of the side problems with this is what we were sold. According to the blurb, which is still on the website at the moment, this is apparently Adam Brace's hilarious and anarchic new play. Okay, well, it's a new play, but funny in parts, certainly, hilarious in parts, possibly not, and hilarious given that at one point we have to deal with the prologue and aftermath of a savage gang rape on a young woman, or a girl, in fact, in which her father is forced to participate. I'm not sure that hilarious comes into that, and also anarchic, I'm not entirely sure where that comes into it. So certainly, in terms of what we're sold to begin with, we're not being sold at all. I found parts of this play rather difficult to believe. The idea that there would need to be a vote on having a certain amount of Congolese participation on the steering committee of something that was people trying to organise a Congolese festival, there would even need to be a vote and that it wouldn't be something that is automatic. I could not understand why that was happening. I didn't understand why it was important. It would seem to me complete common sense. And unless they have lots of other examples of white people saying, oh, well, no, we don't need to involve the diaspora when we are trying to celebrate this sort of thing, unless they've got lots of other examples of this, it just felt to me that the writer didn't understand how these things really work. He's just creating a problem that might not be a problem. I mean, it could have been just as well done if they just started from the point, yes, of course, we've got to have this involvement from the diaspora, and then concentrated on the diaspora not cooperating and all the problems and dealing with that sort of thing. But instead, they make it a vital point that people are either opposed or against this, and there's no logical opposition for this. The opposition actually comes from the fact that the rest of the committee, the NGOs, the white folks on the committee, they just don't trust this character of Steph, this young woman, as you say, born in Kenya, feeling enormous guilt about her father. And that's something else that gave me enormous problems. We're given guilt about her father, guilt about Kenya, as if it's colonial guilt about Kenya, and the numbers don't add up. She's late 20s, early 30s, this is the character of Steph. She would have been born in the 1980s, when Kenya was, well, it's a one-party state, but they still had a semblance of democracy, and in fact had, at the time, had white MPs, and indeed, I believe, someone called Richard Leakey, son of Louis Leakey, who discovered Lucy, the early hominid. He was not only an MP, but also a minister in charge of things like the anthropological culture in Kenya. So if she's born into that Kenya, not into the colonial Kenya of the Mau Mau uprising leading up to independence in Kenya, which happened in 1963, did make me think, well, okay, she's born in the 1980s, that's the kind of Kenya she has, this sort of one-party state, partially democratic Kenya. Is that what she's feeling guilty about? Is that what she feels her father was implicated in? Or are we supposed to simply think, oh no, Kenya, that was a white colony like Zimbabwe or South Africa, so we are supposed to think about the colonial guilt that she's thinking, you know, all the terrible things that happened under the colonies. But her father, unless he was in his 40s or 50s, wouldn't have been involved in that sort of thing. He would have been barely out of his childhood if he had her when he was in his 30s, when all the terrible things, you know, leading up to independence were happening in Kenya. So it didn't make sense almost immediately. And this is something, unfortunately, I'm plagued with. This is sort of sense of historicity, if you like. That sense of, yeah, I can do the dates, I can do the calculations very quickly. It happens without me even thinking about it a lot of the time. And it struck me almost immediately. And I'm thinking, oh yes, they're just using it because they want to generate some kind of colonial guilt here. They want to guilt trip me in some way. They got this idea of the coltan. This is this mineral from which they extract tantalum and niobium, which is, well, very important inside electronics. And so you want me to feel guilty about the way that that is mined. And yes, okay, I will take on my share of guilt about that. I'm quite happy to. But you know that I will. You know that the audience will take on that guilt because we all come to the theatre a certain kind of people. We're not nasty people. We're not people who think colonialism is a great thing. We're not people who think that taking advantage of minors, allowing terrible things to happen to minors and minors' families, having them under threat, we don't think that this is a good thing, and we will feel guilty. You're preaching to the choir. You're preaching to people who you know will feel bad about this sort of thing. You want to do something about feeling guilty about Democratic Republic of Congo, set it in Belgium. Deal with Belgian people feeling guilty about this, because it's very difficult to feel guilty about coltan. It really is. I know I should. I know, and I do. I do feel slightly guilty about it. But, you know, I can't help feeling that there are other people who should be feeling more ashamed of themselves than me. A lot more ashamed of themselves than me, and you're not talking to them, you're talking to me, and you know I will feel guilty, and you're taking advantage of that, and there is part of me that resents that a lot. And these kind of feelings rather spoil the play, because the stuff about the Congolese diaspora and their fights, I would love to have talked just about that, but instead, I'm introduced to it by a rather silly white girl, to be honest, and although Fiona Button is an actress I like a lot, I really didn't like her character at all. I just didn't get on with her. I didn't, you know, I had problems with her whole Kenyan background. I didn't think it was well enough thought out and well enough researched almost immediately. I didn't think that the committee stuff worked at all. It just didn't make sense to me, her insistence on the participation of the Congolese and it being a matter for an important vote. And she seemed singly incapable of doing this organisation, and yes, you could see why she felt guilty, and there's this incident where she is in the Democratic Republic of Congo comes across the aftermath of a rape attack and basically frees it, finding herself completely useless, not able to do anything apart from sit with a phone while the real help, the real people who can do something about this, actually do something about it, and feeling completely useless and therefore trying to make up to it by coming up with this festival. But she's woefully inadequate to even do the festival. There are much better qualified people whose advice that she doesn't want to listen to, and she's got this E-Day fix about participation, which I didn't even think was going to be an issue. And I much rather have seen a play that concentrated on the Congolese diaspora in London, which are fascinating, which has all the heart and all the comedy. You have the character of Anne-Marie, who is part of the Congolese diaspora and is the one person who sticks with the committee throughout, while other parts of the diaspora aren't willing to be on the committee. And she is a fascinating character. We hear about her father. Well, why couldn't we see her father? Why couldn't we talk to her father? Why couldn't we have more about her relationship with her daughter? I'm much more interested in that Congolese diaspora than I was in anything to do with Seth and her, to a certain extent, her inadequacies. I wasn't interested in her. And yes, it's a decently written play, and all the bits are, and there are lots of fascinating bits in it, and there are lots of funny bits in it, but I just had too many objections, I think, too many objections to the young woman to really get on with this play. And there is very little economy in this play. They explain things too much. There are times when he does suggest relationships and things very effectively, but sometimes he just over-explains, and it's just too long a play, because it's 2 hours 40 minutes when I saw it. I recognise that a lot of people have seen this play and given it 4 stars and said it's a wonderful play and how brilliant it is, so I'm probably in the wrong. It's probably because I took against the young woman that they focus on primarily and wasn't therefore able to appreciate the rest of it more, because I think the essentials, as I said, the parts about the Congolese diaspora, the parts about the Congo are fascinating and interesting and things we need to care about, but I was not caring about this young woman, and I think that gave me problems with the play.
I take issue with you on a number of points, I think. The first is that I don't think Steph's motivation has got a lot to do with her kind of colonial past, for want of a better word. I think her motivation is about her experience in the DRC and what she witnessed in the DRC. And indeed, what we haven't talked about is throughout the play, there is a ghostly figure who is effectively is a representative of what she experienced. And I think that represents, you know, her guilt. That's what she's seeking to assuage, you know, what she actually experienced, what she actually saw. And I think the second point I'd make is that by effectively giving them all a hard time, the NGOs and the diaspora and the colonists and the dictators and the corrupt people in the country and the militia, what the play is basically saying is that what about the people of the DRC? Because nobody is acting in their interests. Everybody's acting in some sort of bizarre self-interest or some version of what they think their interest might or should be. And I think those are two quite important points. And therefore, I think that it does make very good points about the plight of this country, albeit the hopelessness of it. It's very hard to see how do you get out of this cycle, because none of the players that we meet, and indeed the ones we don't meet, seem to have any interest in the people of the DRC. The interests seem to be much more narrow than that. So, you know, I understand the points you're making, but I think that if you look at it at a big picture level, I think it is making quite important points.
We're now going to talk about 946, the amazing story of Adolphus Tipps, which is Nihai's production at the Globe Theatre. This is an adaptation of Michael Morpurgo's novel, adapted by Michael Morpurgo and Emma Rice, and directed by Emma Rice. We are told that this is 1944. We are in Devon. We are near a place called Slapton Sands, which might tell one or two people a great deal about it, but we are in the build up to D-Day. Gareth, can you tell me more about this and what you think of it?
This is a Nihai show, and I always thought that Nihai would suit the Globe space, and indeed it does. But it also turns out that Michael Morpurgo and Nihai are actually pretty much a match made in heaven as well. So I thought this was really lovely storytelling. It was very funny, very moving, and very captivating. And it's sort of one of those shows that had you both laughing and crying, really. And so I really adored it. Now, I hadn't read the Michael Morpurgo novel, and I didn't know, at least I'm assuming it was a novel, and I didn't know anything about the true story that it's actually based on. So the backdrop is the events leading up to the D-Day landings in 1944, and the US forces had arrived on the South Devon coast because they were effectively going to have rehearsals on the beaches in readiness for D-Day. So in November, before the landings, in November 1943, the local people were actually evacuated from their homes and moved to other homes nearby. And some of them already had evacuees from London in their homes, so that this Exercise Tiger, which was the main rehearsal, could take place. But because there was a lack of a second vessel and there were some cock-ups in communication, as it were, 946 men died in Exercise Tiger in the rehearsal, hence the title of the play. And at the time, that was hushed up. And it was 40 years before the truth really came out into the public domain. So this is the story that he's telling, but he's doing it through the life of a 12-year-old girl called Lily. And Lily's dad is away in the war, not in the D-Day landings, but away in the war, I think, in North Africa. And she lives with her cat Tips, with her mum and her granddad, on this farm in Slapton. And then when they're evacuated, the London evacuee, and indeed Lily's school friend Barry, joins them. So we have an evacuee from London in the group now. And their teacher in the school is herself Jewish French refugee. She's come over to England from France to escape what the Nazis were doing in France. And when the Americans arrive, they're befriended by two young black American GIs, Adolphus and Harry, and they become very fond of Lily, and Lily and the family become very fond of them. And that's a sort of a very charming sort of aspect to the show, really. I guess black GIs would not be that, you know, we wouldn't see that so much in the UK. And their welcome was clearly very warm. And the show is actually bookended by contemporary scenes where we meet an elderly Lily, who's now a grandma, as she loses her husband. And that frees her to return to her past, and we explore the past, and I won't sort of say what happens from there, really. But the whole story is very, very heartwarming. You know, what we've got is three cultures colliding here. We've got the French teacher and the American GIs and the British country folk. And that provides a lot of comedy, but it also provides an awful lot of warmth and empathy as well. There is a lot of music. Some of it's original, some of them well-known songs. And there's a blues man and his band who are sitting above the stage. And sometimes the cast join in on instruments, you know, sometimes they're bottles and spoons and vocals and whatever. Most of the set is sandbags and tin baths, which are used to great effect, I have to say, that design's by Les Brotherston. And the way they tell the Exercise Tiger story is particularly inspired, particularly delightful piece of staging. I just thought it was just a lovely show. It's a great ensemble. You know, Mike Shepherd is here, not in his underpants this time. He's here as granddad, but he's also the contemporary Lily. He's also playing a woman as well. We've got a lovely role by Adam Sopp, who's the sort of Cockney evacuee. And then he also doubles up as the contemporary grandson, Bowie. And then the two GIs are Nakuta Gatwa and Nandi Bibi, are very charming. And then we've got Ewan Wardrop, who's got a lovely, lovely cameo as Barry's mum. She turns up from London to sort of see her boy. But the star of the show, unquestionably, is Katie Owen, who plays a 12-year-old so completely believable. And she's just feisty and cheeky and just absolutely terrific. So I thought it was a really, you know, it's a delightful evening. It's actually quite enthralling storytelling, and I wouldn't have missed it for the world. A lovely, lovely evening at the Globe.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azzetta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.